C1G.
Number 2A.
We considered yesterday the biblical note, the first one, and we have to see very clearly there that we are not misled by the term Jehovah, the way the Jehovistic document uses that term, but that this verse is from the priestly document and not from the Jehovistic document, and naturally the priestly document has a very high sense of God. Here, Jehovah is introduced as Elohim, Elohim, Jehovah, which means I am that I am. And that was the name that right before was revealed to Moses when he went to Mount Horeb. So, what this scripture note wants to bring out is that in Genesis, we do not have to deal with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that we do not have to deal with our God, with our concept of God, that we have to deal with a concept of God that is independent on any personal sense about God, namely that God is just I am that I am. I am from everlasting to the everlasting what I am. And therefore gives a very impersonal sense of God as the being that is, as the supreme being. Now, the moment this idea is established in consciousness that what we call God is the one infinite being, the infinite one, then at once the question comes, now, what about the relation of God to man? And the second scriptural note which Mrs. Eddy gives here, which is from John, from the Gospel of John, shows how that Jehovah, that I am, is translating itself to man. Namely, John writes here, I read the second scriptural note, all things were made by him. Can you see? Now suddenly you have God made. That's no more being. And here we approach that great question in Genesis, is there being or is there becoming? Is there being or is there a creative activity going on? So all things were made by him. And without him was not anything made that was made. And the third stage, in him was life, and the life was the light of men. And you can see that here is depicted the relationship between God, the I am that I am, and man. And what John shows here are actually three steps, and those three steps correspond with the three parts of the chapter in Genesis. You know that the chapter in Genesis has three parts, you have studied that. That it has, first part is the true record of creation. The second part is the false record of creation. And then Mrs. Eddy adds a third part in which she deals no more with a biblical sense of creation, but with an evolutionary sense of creation. She takes up the theory of evolution of life and deals with the various aspects or various beliefs about the evolution on the earth. If you have that in you, those three parts, you can see that in a nutshell, Mrs. Eddy now presents those three parts. I go over that verse again. All things were made by him. See, that's the first record of creation. Where in the first record of creation, God is presented as the creator. He creates all. Nothing is said about man's universe, the universe of matter, of error, and so on. Then we have the second step, and without him was not anything made that was made. You see, that covers really the second record of creation, which puts forth the belief that out of the dust of the ground, out from another source than the one being, has been created another creation, the Adam creation. And the second record of creation wants to prove that the Adam creation is not the true creation, that it is a false concept of the first record of creation, so that it shows that without him, without God, was not anything made that was made. Therefore, it shows the nothingness of the second record of creation, the Adam record of creation. Then John goes on to a third step. In him was life. In him, in God, was life. And the life was the light of men. Men here in the plural. Therefore, what he shows is that really God is life, and that life is the creator of all. And therefore, not like in the theories of evolution, that matter is the creator of all, and that all started with matter, with the Big Bang, and then afterwards the forming of the universe, the forming of the earth, afterwards the forming of the first living cell, and that evolved and evolved and evolved and brought life to earth, so that the belief there is that out of matter, life came into existence. Whereas what he is going to show in the third part is actually that life is the creator of everything. Well, that's the scriptural note. And if we ask ourselves now, what does that mean? You see, the scriptural notes were always trying to give the core of a whole chapter, to try in biblical language to show what the chapter is all about. Here you can see the first scriptural note would say to us, look here, we don't have to deal with your concept of God, Abraham, Jacob, Isaac and Jacob's concept of God. What we have to deal with is that there is an I am that I am, that there is a Lord God, Jehovah. The I am that I am. Lord Jehovah is also called as the first cause, as the eternal cause. In that way, the Bible commentary explains it. So that we have first the establishment within our consciousness that there is being, capital B, the supreme being. But that supreme being, through the second biblical note, shows that is the being of all being, small b, of all existence, and that it shows that there is no other existence beside God, no second record of creation, no Adam record, and that is the life of all men. That therefore, the third part of the chapter, we see that is the source of being about everything. Yes. And with these two scriptural notes, Mrs. Eddy starts with the text. And on page 501 and 2, to the point where she starts with the exegesis of the first record of creation, she gives a few introductory paragraphs. And these introductory paragraphs talk about two necessities for beginning with Genesis. She gives two reasons. The first reason which she gives here is that it is necessary to start with the Old Testament because of what? Because, she says, the text at the beginning especially when you take Genesis, that that text is obscure, that it is smothered, that it is not easily to be understood, not easily to be interpreted, that it lends itself to a lot of misinterpretation. And therefore, even more, we should see the right interpretation of the beginning of the Old Testament. And we will see that, and I think this is one of the great difficulties that the student of the Bible has, that he is not aware, especially when we come to the second record of creation, which is from the Jahvistic document, that it is an old document with very crude symbols, with a crude language. The symbolism is inexact because at that time they would not even know how to do it better. They did the best job they could do at that time. But thinking that myths and the creation myths and sagas of the wandering of the tribes and so on at the beginning of the Old Testament were all formulated first verbally, perhaps 2000 BC, 1000 BC, that they were handed down from one generation to the next generation by word of mouth. You just can see how these little tribes with their herds and so were in the desert, that at night they would sit around the fire, and that grandpa would tell the little children all the nice stories about their tribe and their history and so on. And what could he use as symbols for teaching spiritual reality, spiritual facts? Nothing but that crude, half-hidden Jewish history. And therefore, we should be aware of that so that we don't fall into that mistake, as we see it often and often, time and time again. That we don't fall into that mistake of taking every word, especially of the second record of creation, take every word as sacrosanct. Do you say sacrosanct? Yes, as holy. Huh? Not realizing really that they are English words, which are a translation perhaps from the Latin, perhaps from the Greek, perhaps from the Hebrew, that they translated it from documents that were copies of copies of copies of copies of copies and not originals, that even these copies were for which we don't know the original, that even those originals were written in a time when the people had no exact symbols in order to bring out a spiritual vision, a spiritual teaching. Therefore, we must see that we are not relying too much on single terms, or it doesn't make sense. And that is what Mrs. Eddy wants to show here, that really she had to start with the beginning of the Old Testament, because what is stated there textually is rather obscure, it's smothered. She even says that at times it seems contradictory. She says, literally taken, the text is made to appear contradictory in some place. All these contradictions have to be resolved first so that we can have a true interpretation. So, especially when it comes to the second record of creation, we have to see that we need somehow the spiritual sense of what they wanted to convey. We have to get the feel of how they tried to symbolize deep spiritual things with these crude symbols of nature symbols, of tribal symbols, and things like that. Whereas Mrs. Eddy then states in that first paragraph that the New Testament is much clearer and comes nearer to the heart, and that Jesus illumines them through his healing activities, and that they explain much clearer all the miracles and the mystery. So actually what she wants to show here is that she is going to explain scientifically. She starts with scientific interpretation. I will come back to that. But you see, she starts out with scientific interpretation, not literal interpretation of the Bible. But that scientific interpretation gives or throws a true light on the first and second record of creation, and that afterwards Jesus would be able to demonstrate that true interpretation. As if she would say, and she does say, I give the right interpretation of the Bible. She says that afterwards, I give the right interpretation, showing that she gives the interpretation of the days of creation as the key to the Bible. And that with that key understood, Jesus could demonstrate those 7 days of creation and could fulfill the days of creation. In the same way, indicating for us that if we also begin to say, to understand and to see through the symbolism of those two records, that this would give us such a key, such a definite understanding of the fundamentals of the Bible. This would actually also enable us to practice on that basis. So this is one point, one necessity, and a second necessity, which she says is the following. Its marginal heading is Spiritual Overture, and she calls Genesis, so to say, a prelude to the older scriptures. It's a prelude. Well, in a prelude, you already find first the main melodies, so to say, indicated. Then after the prelude, the whole symphony would elaborate that fundamental theme, and that is actually how we will see also this week the whole Bible, that so to say, if we understand the first record of creation and the second record of creation in its spiritual order, in its mathematical order, that then this prelude will enable us really to interpret the whole Bible. Just as in music, the symphony then will elaborate on those few simple facts of that simple order of the 7 days of creation. So that all the rest that comes afterwards, right up to Christian science, that fundamental melody of the 7 days of creation in all the variations we can think of. So that we can get the feeling that understanding the 7 days of creation is so fundamental that we can't miss it. That is, I guess, also the reason which you may have asked for yourself, why does Mrs. Eddy only explain the first and second record of creation? Why doesn't she explain anything anymore until she comes to the end of the Bible in Apocalypse? Why doesn't she give us an interpretation of the whole Bible? And here she indicates it. It says, if you have a prelude, and if you understand that prelude, then she says, the whole Bible is nothing else but a great elaboration of that fundamental scale from the first to the seventh day. So, that a second necessity is, as she would show, that there is a prelude, but that it is so short that usually so short and so negative as in the second record of creation that one forgets the importance of it, because it seems that unreality is mightier than reality, that the straight line of spirit is no more seen, but all the mortal deviations from the Adam story onward is being depicted over chapters and chapters, over books and books, And so it is a difficulty not to forget that really the very beginning gives us the key. She goes on to the next third paragraph, still elaborating on that second necessity of being able to perceive that short prelude of the first record of creation by showing that the book of Genesis, seen as a whole, seems to be the history of a sinful man and not what it actually is, namely the declaration and the presentation of God's nature in its sevenfold way. This is so short, it just takes one chapter, and all the rest of the Old Testament then is showing really the deflection of being, the history, as she says, of a sinful mortal. It depicts the falsity of error and the effect of error. Still, she says, this is a great mystery. It's a great point in scientific interpretation, that even the false history is of value. That if we take the false history and see it from the point of view of the first record of creation, namely from the true history, the false history is of great importance in spiritual teaching. Because, she says, rightly viewed, this is the main point, rightly viewed. What happens with all that history of error if rightly viewed? She says, rightly viewed, then it shows the spiritual actuality of man. How? Naturally, by reversing error and seeing that error is not something per se, is not an existence and an entity by itself, but that it is the suggestion of a suppositional opposite of God. Therefore, as a suppositional opposite, it has no reality per se, but indicates, through reversion, the truth about everything. So that we actually can take that whole Bible, or let's say the Old Testament, especially the historical books, say up to the prophets, we can take them, though they depict a long history of error, and only here and there intermixed by the truth that handles that error, we can really see that the history of error is a very great teaching. Because rightly viewed, we can see how truth uncovers error. How the first record of creation is actually that truth which alone can uncover that the second record of creation is wrong. I don't know how far this is true in this country, but I'm quite sure it is true in this country, or anyway, if I look back and consider what the biblical interpreter of the first and second record of creation were saying about them, they never accepted them as two distinct records until very lately. Now, over the last 10 years or so, they begin to acknowledge that they are two very different records, that they are not one story of God, that the second record of creation, they begin to see, are a false record. No, not a false record. That they are a record of a false sense of creation and no more God's acting. So finally they begin to realize after 100 years of the leavening of Christian Science in general human consciousness, that they begin to realize now that God was not responsible for Adam, for the creation of Adam, and for the creation of Eve, and for the creation of a serpent, and all the story that followed after that. They begin now to say very distinctly in their books, there is a first record of creation, and there is a wrong sense of creation, the second record of creation. But Mrs. Eddy could see that 100 years ago, and I remember as a young student at the university when talking with my colleagues from the theological department, and it was just impossible to bring forth such a concept. They wanted to have God and God creating Adam and having the finger in that whole Adam story. So here we can see the relationship, namely that the true record of creation is that which alone is able to see the second record of creation rightly, namely as error, as a history of error. Before that, you go to the theologian, the second record of creation is the record of truth. That's true, what happened there. Man has fallen. There was an Eve that was tempted, and she is to be blamed, and all that stuff. Whereas we can see that only knowing the true record of creation gives us that standard according to which we can measure what is not coming up to that standard, which does not coincide with that standard. And therefore, everything that does not coincide with the standard, we have the right to say, this is wrong. If it is wrong, then rightly viewed, it serves to help to understand truth. The more we understand truth, the more we uncover error. The more we uncover error, the more we see the nothingness of error, and therefore the more we see the factuality of truth. And so in this way she says, well, that scientific, when we interpret it and view it rightly, then it helps to see scientifically Christian views of the universe, and then they appear.